Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. This episode is from the Momentum Series, resurfacing the most popular episodes from our archives to shine a light on the continued growth of companies in our network. And now, on to the show.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Today, super excited. We're fortunate to have Sarah Dusick with us. Sarah is the investor and co-founder of Enigma Ventures, as well as the co-founder and CEO of Few and Far. Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much.
So with that, let's jump right into it. And if we can start with a bit of background on yourself, we'd love to hear about your journey and how it is that you became to be a partner at Enigma.
Yeah, I became an investor because I was an entrepreneur first. And what I realized about being an entrepreneur trying to build an early stage company and grow and scale that company was that actually there were very few women investing in early stage businesses. And I found that whole scenario difficult to navigate. And made a decision in my own head at one point in my journey while I was raising capital for my own business that if I did ever sell my company for a large amount of money, that I would become the investor I never had. So that was my impetus for becoming an investor.
Fantastic. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot we can unpack in the time we have as being a woman, not only starting a company, but also investing in them. And so if we would go through, I'd love to get more of your perspective on that. But the other thing is very unique. You know, in my experience, investors who have an operating background are in the minority. And so I think it's another, you know, I'd love to hear your perspective on how the time you spent building your company influences your how you think about investing today.
Well, I it's very easy for me to get inside the entrepreneur's head because I've been in their shoes and I really know what it feels like, not only just to battle through the things that you have to navigate as a founder, but how to emotionally navigate them. And I happen to think that a large part of an entrepreneur's success is to do with mindset. It's to do with how you can navigate difficulty, your stickability, your ability to be all in on something. And, you know, the founder journey is tough. It's very tough. And having operators alongside you who walked that journey, who know what it feels like, who can really understand the difficulties you're going through and that you don't have to pretend with. I mean, I think that's one of the hard things about having investors on your cap table is, you know, ideally, you want to always present to them the rosy, sunny side up. Everything's shiny. Everything's fantastic. And of course, that's just not reality with growing and scaling a business. I mean, it's barely ever rosy. You know, you might have a rainbow, you know, once a decade or not quite that infrequently, but, you know, it's a very hard slog. And I think having people alongside you who can understand that and champion you and help you get up when you're down is really important. And who can bring a level of expertise to say, I've been here. I know what this means. I know what this looks like. Here's some ideas for how we navigate our way through it. I think it's helpful.
Okay. And so with that, you know, as it pertains to investment strategy, I think great place to start would be Enigma's investment thesis. How do you go about identifying high potential startups?
Yeah, we invest only in female founders, which is my attempt to counter steer against gender imbalance in the startup world. We know we've got 98% of all venture capital going to male founders. So our fund is designed to try and contribute towards getting dollars to typically underfunded founders. And I specifically fund female founders in Africa. So I have another layer of nuance in terms of what we do. And that for me is also very intentional and very personal in the sense of, I firmly believe that businesses are a catalyst for economic development and economic growth. And so I'm super interested in helping undeveloped / developing nations move forward. And I know the best way we can do that is not give handouts, but give hand ups. And we do that by building great businesses that build economies and help local people solve local problems.
Fantastic mission. Love it. Be curious to know, so as compared to their male counterparts, are there any reoccurring themes of strengths among female founders that you've seen over the years? Consistent strengths.
Interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting question. Consistent strengths. I see a high level of emotional intelligence amongst female founders. I mean, maybe not surprisingly, but there's an acute awareness that's very different than our male counterparts. We typically tend to be better at, I think we're typically better people managers. I think we're more intuitive. And I think we're better listeners. So what we, you know, and sometimes to our fault, we're a bit more realistic. That can be a disadvantage in the venture capital space. You know, you are rewarded for being bold and brave, not conservative and realistic. But women tend to consistently deliver performance more consistently, and tend to be, I mean, this is very generic, but tend to have sort of a better consistent performance rate overall.
Okay. And so that said, you know, I'd be curious to know if there are any sectors in particular that you're bullish on. And then if, you know, if you take it a step further, how does that dovetail with a C-suite that just has a better job of connecting with their team, their clients, their vendors?
Yeah, I'm an unusual investor in that I tend to zig when other people are zagging, in the sense that I'm typically not jumping on the super hot bandwagons that everyone's jumping on. Although, having said that, I had several AI investments before AI was a thing. I consider myself sector agnostic, but I tend to love investing in things that have a high degree of impact. So they have strong potential for strong financial return, but they also have a high possibility of driving high impact at the same time.
Okay. And so with that, I'd love to get a little bit in the weeds. If you have a story about an existing portfolio or past portfolio company, and how they navigated growth and the associated challenges.
Yeah, well, I've had several companies in the fintech space that have really done extraordinarily well over the last few years. And their growth has largely been because of the lack of capital in the markets. And when I built my own company, and often our best investments has been when there's pent up demand. So almost like when you provide a solution to demand that, you know, wasn't necessarily being met in the market, you know, you can drive enormous growth by just harnessing demand that wasn't being met in the market. And several of our fintech companies are focused on serving an unbanked population, i.e. in designing financial service products for, you know, people who are trading or living on $2 or $3 a day. So sort of the lowest socioeconomic demographic of society, but creating financial services for them that provides capital, provides loans, provides saving products, provides insurance, and the huge amount of scale that is possible in that space is sadly enormous, but is a real opportunity for lifting people out of poverty and creating opportunities for people to make money, because it's very hard to make money with no money, right? So when you have no opportunity for access to capital to do anything with. There's no opportunity to advance. And so we've seen enormous success in that arena, which has been really fascinating to watch. But the interesting thing about it for me, sort of retrospectively, sort of analyzing those investments and analyzing my own growth as I grew my own company, harnessing pent-up demand was a real lever of growth.
So I'm inferring from your response that there's a significant underserved demographic within Africa. And that makes me think we probably can devote an entire podcast to the subject as well. But for the benefit of our listeners, can you provide, you know, maybe just a general profile overview of the African market? And I don't know, I'll leave to you if that's completely just geography-based, country-based, but I think that would be a valuable primer.
Well, what we have in a massive continent is a billion people, a billion people who are all on a cell phone, who are all digitally connected, whether you live on $2 a day or $500 a day or more, everybody has a cell phone. So Africa has become increasingly digitized over the last few years. And what we're seeing is a continent that's leapfrogging. So banking systems in Africa, for example, tend to be infinitely more advanced than the US, for example, because they've had to digitize much more rapidly than the US has. You won't ever find anyone in Africa writing a check, never, for example. You will find a multitude of payment apps and wallets and the ability to move money between country easily. There have been so many advances, which actually ultimately will benefit the Western world as the Western world catches up, because of there was a missing middle, if you like. And that creates opportunities in itself. And we see that in a number of sectors with the ability to sort of leapfrog ahead with not bothering with, I mean, if we just take the cell phone, for example, nobody's got a landline. So we'll leapfrog over the landline stage and we'll go straight to smartphones with connectivity and apps and the ability to have money on your phone and all the rest of it. Your bank is in your phone effectively. And we're seeing that happen in the energy sector also. There's insufficient power supply for the demand across the continent. And we're going to see, and we are beginning to see, a leapfrogging into a green economy, I think much faster than we'll see one happen in the US. And so there are all these sort of different focus areas where Africa really, because we're such a large population, will be able to see a huge amounts of leapfrogging and, you know, leaving things that you or I might have used or been, you know, a basic, you know, fundamental thing about our own lives will not happen here, but we'll leapfrog across into new technologies and new frontiers. And I think that's exciting. We've also got a very, very young workforce. I think by 2050, 25% of the world's workforce is going to be on the African continent. So tech capabilities and tech skills are going to be increasingly common and normal if we're going to make sure that 25% of the world's population is employed. And I think seeing the advancement of, you know, the extreme advancement of technology happening here is going to really help move the continent forward much quicker.
I mean, that was a great recap. You made me bullish.
great.
Why not tell you?
It's a frontier, right? And so, you know, it's kind of sort of the last frontier, if we like, in terms of mass opportunities still existing. And that's largely because of lack of investment and lack of development, you know, over the last, you know, few decades. And so now there's an opportunity really to do cutting edge stuff here. That's really quite exciting.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I just a couple of thoughts that come to me, but one in particular is, you know, the lack of a historical infrastructure like you'd find in Europe or in the US has a silver lining, as you're pointing out, in that you do not have to now allocate any expense cost to managing that infrastructure.
No, you just start from scratch, and you sort of, you could, there's an opportunity to implement, you know, clean energy, clean roads, you know, new transport systems. There's, you know, there's, yes, there's still a lot of infrastructure work that needs to be done, but we can do it in an advanced way without having to say, well, first we've got to do this and then we'll move on. You know, now we can just go straight to the end goal.
I'm curious, and all good if the response is anecdotal, but do you have an idea as to what percent of the working population does so remote in Africa?
Actually have no idea. We do know that across the continent that the largest sector of society is still employed in agriculture. So agriculture is still sort of the largest aggregate of what people do for work.
Got it.
I'm anticipating that percentage will change very drastically over the next 25 years.
I would imagine with advancements in ag tech, it'll minimize the requirement for human capital, notwithstanding the introduction of robots, which I'm sure is coming as well.
And I think just different farming practices. I mean, Africa historically has been very good at subsistence farming, and as opposed to large scale commercial farming. But I think with a wave of regenerative agriculture and thinking about land management and soil health very differently than we've thought about it historically, I think that's another opportunity for the continent to sort of lead and advance in a wave of, okay, we have a large rural populations who traditionally have made their money or have subsisted through agriculture. And how do we start to change that? And one of the large projects I'm working on at the moment is we are developing another, I made my money in travel and we're developing another travel company now, but we are focusing our energies and efforts on regenerating vast areas of wilderness to restore and rewild and capture carbon in the soil. And Africa is an extraordinary place for us to be able to capture carbon, improve soil health, and create a healthy planet. Invest in Africa, you know, invest in the health of the planet. So I think that's a very interesting opportunity for the continent also.
And with that, so knowing that there's tremendous growth opportunities ahead, as an investor, what type of support do you find yourself typically providing your portfolio companies beyond funding?
I consider myself a coach and a mentor and an advisor. I'm at the end of the phone when things are going bad. I'm at the end of the phone when things are going well to celebrate and cheer. And I consider myself someone who gets the privilege of walking alongside entrepreneurs and trying to share my wisdom and knowledge and my mistakes. You know, I think we don't often talk enough about how much failure actually happens in an entrepreneur's journey. I don't know a single successful entrepreneur who hasn't, you know, couldn't list off, you know, 5 to 10 major mistakes they made along the way. It just doesn't happen. And you know, I think that's another one of the benefits of having been an operator, is to not sweat the stuff that doesn't go the way we thought it was going to go. But just knowing all of it is learning, you know. And when I first started investing, I certainly wished that some of my entrepreneurs would have listened to the things I learned the hard way, and, you know, didn't make some of the same mistakes that I made. But some of those mistakes, I think, were inevitable anyway. You know, it's sometimes you can only learn through your own mistakes. You don't necessarily want to learn from someone else's mistakes. But where it's valuable and where folks will listen, I'm certainly offering up my learnings and my own failings.
There's a tremendous amount of wisdom in that statement. I'm curious, is there a common pitfall that you see that you'd encourage entrepreneurs to be aware of?
Oh, I just think there are so many pitfalls. I liken the entrepreneurship journey to like walking through a field full of landmines. And, it's unlikely, you're unlikely to come out the other side without having lost, a finger or an arm or a, something. It's difficult to come out of it unscathed for sure. I guess we often underestimate the power of intuition. And I am a very intuitive person, especially when I'm tuning into myself and I'm listening to myself. I often, even now, still ignore some of my strong gut instincts that I have that inevitably, if I'd have listened to them, would have steered me clear of some big potholes or landmines. And I think often we think other people have the answer, or we listen to somebody who's supposedly an expert when our intuition is telling us something else. And that can be hard to navigate your way through. But my advice would be if your intuition is something else, you'd be really wrong. It's not the smartest thing to do to ignore it and just take the supposedly expert opinion and row with that.
Okay. Any red flags in particular that come to mind?
I think with regards to other investors, certainly on my own journey, if you don't like the people who are looking to do an investment deal with you before you've even closed the deal, don't close the
Hmm.
deal. There's an old adage that says, if people show you who they are, believe them. And if people show you who they are and you don't like who they show you to be, don't imagine they're going to change. So yeah, certainly my biggest red flags have always been around people.
Agree 100%. Very wise advice and insight. So on that, relationships, what advice do you have for founders looking to pitch to investors for the first time?
Well, relationships really, really matter in this space. And even, I know this maybe sounds really simplistic, but even relationships with your banker matter. Like, not just an investor, but who you bank with matters. Do you have a relationship where they know you by name and you can call them up and they can call you? And if there's something seems odd. I remember in one of my early days, I had a phone call from my banker, and we banked with a small little local bank in Montana. Our headquarters for the business that we grew to being worth over $100 million came out of Montana, which is not the usual place you'd think of for growing a big company. But we had a great banker, and I remember him calling me one day and saying, "Sarah, did you want me to move $50,000 to over here? Your CFO just emailed me and asked me to move $50,000 over here." And I thought that was a bit strange. And it was a bit strange because it was a phishing exercise where someone had impersonated our CFO and had messaged our banker and asked him to move money to their account. Now, because I had a relationship with him, he called and it didn't, he called me to check. And if we'd have been in a different banking scenario where it was all just transactional and, nobody knew us and nobody had any sort of eyeballs on what our accounts were usually doing and the things we usually asked for, they probably would have just moved the money. And so, I cannot overestimate how important relationships are. Even relationships that you don't think are very significant to you today, because you never know when you're going to need somebody. And when you're going to need to be able to call them up and say, "I would love an introduction to this person person that you know, or, you know, I would love, could you get me into this conference that I really want to attend, or whatever it is, you know, or I need to meet this person. We're trying to do business with this person. Could you make an introduction? And whether you've got a relationship with somebody or not can often be the make or break between, you know, getting that deal, making things happen, having access to something, raising more capital. And so, you know, keeping good relationships and having real relationships is important. And one of the things I noticed about women actually is that we traditionally have underestimated the power of networking. We've underestimated the power of connections for doing business. And I do think men have realized this a lot long ago. And we have been a little bit late to the party because everything we have had to have done has been very transactional and very achievement basis. So we've achieved something and then you can do something. And often that's how women think about networking is, you know, you do a good job, you get a pat on the back, or, you know, you fulfill your role and everything's good. You don't do that and everything's bad. Whereas you and I know, business is much more opaque than that. Whether you get the deal or whether something happens often depends whether you know someone or they know someone that, you know, wants to make an introduction to you, and they'll talk about you in the room when you're not in the room. So relationships are everything.
100% agree. My son, who's now is a business owner, has his own construction firm in Nashville, Tennessee, likes to say it's the hands you shake, not the grade you make, Dad.
Yeah.
To help justify his academic performance, but inconsequential because he's extremely successful today.
It's so true. And, you know, that is sort of even above and beyond what a contract says, right? So you might have contracted something with somebody and all the fine print in the world is in there. But actually, if you've got a good relationship with someone, you're not going to sue them and they're not going to sue you, and you're going to work out any kind of conflict you might have in a business relationship because you have a relationship. And, you know, that becomes, you know, utmost for, I think, for the way we can make things happen and get business done. And everyone wins.
I love it. You know, I absolutely 100% agree. I think, you know, sometimes it takes a little bit of faith that that's the case. But that's been my experience as well.
Which is, you need your intuition up front with, like, is this the person I want to do business with? Because the best contract in the world is not going to protect you from a fraudster. You know, that's why, you know, building a relationship, figuring out who someone is, figuring out if they're genuine, figuring out how they do business and does it align with the way you want to do business is always good before you get into bed with someone.
100% agreed. I would love to continue on with our podcast, but I see we're coming up on the time. A couple more questions and before we wrap up. What do you find is the most challenging part of being a venture capital investor and most rewarding?
I think the most rewarding is, of course, seeing other people succeed and making things happen that would not have been possible otherwise. That's extraordinary to see things come to life in ways that, you know, could never have been without the investment. So that's exciting. What was the first part of the question? The most difficult, most challenging. I think the most challenging part is when things don't go to plan and how you both navigate your way through something not working out and how resilient everyone is to pivoting, adjusting, learning. I say to the entrepreneurs I work with all the time, you know, your business can only really grow as fast as you can grow. You have to be growing personally. You have to be learning. You know, we're always going to be on a vertical learning curve if we're trying to grow fast. So, you know, sometimes that challenge can be a huge challenge. And whether you can mount that mountain can be very difficult.
And so with that, before we wrap up, for our female founders, C-suite, and our audience today, any last piece, words of advice that you'd like to leave with them?
Yeah, don't let anyone ever tell you no. everyone else is very entitled to their opinion, but do not let it influence what you think is possible or what you want to pull off.
I think it's great advice. Sarah, thank you so much for your time. This is a great podcast. Before we wrap up, if people want to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
Yeah, you can find me on my website, sarahhdusick.com. Everything about my fund and my new book is out on there. So yeah, head on over.
New book,
Thinking Bigger, A Pitch Deck Formula for Women Who Want to Change the World. So the book documents my journey growing and scaling under Canvas and dissects the pitch deck into 10 pages, 10 chapters on each page of the pitch deck, helping entrepreneurs understand what investors are looking for in early stage businesses trying to raise capital.
And I have a feeling it doesn't matter what continent you're on. You get a
It's the same.
Good stuff. Sarah, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And that calls it for another episode of the Innovators Investors Podcast. Again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinTran Management. Thank you. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.